From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The U.S. is apparently pulling out of Syria. The latest tweet from President Donald Trump said, quote, "After historic victories against ISIS, it's time to bring our great young people home," closed quote. We begin with this report from Dan Cohen, given to RT on Wednesday.
We now have official confirmation that U.S. troops will be leaving Syria. Now, there are at least 2,000 U.S. troops in Syria, and removing them would be fulfillment of one of President Trump's campaign promises. Now, Vice President Mike Pence and the Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, are meeting right now in the Pentagon. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders released a statement saying the process of returning troops back to the U.S. has actually already begun. Now, the statement also says that this doesn't signal the end of the global coalition to defeat ISIS or its campaign. Now, ISIS has been defeated in the sense it holds no territory. Perhaps President Trump is overstating the U.S. role in that effort. ISIS was largely defeated by the Syrian and Russian militaries, along with the Lebanese group Hezbollah. Now, the timing here is very curious. Turkey is threatening an offensive on U.S.-backed Kurdish forces in northern Syria, and President Erdogan has demanded that the U.S.-backed forces withdraw and said that the operation to attack them could start any moment. So Turkey is unlikely to attack U.S. forces, and this could very much factor into President Trump's decision to remove American forces.
Meanwhile, a major development was announced after a meeting between Syria, Russia, Iran, and Turkey towards a political settlement of the crisis in Syria. This was Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, on Wednesday.
We have a very useful meeting with the Secretary General Special Envoy, agreed to take efforts aimed at convening the first session of the Constitutional Committee in Geneva early next year. These steps will lead to the launch of a viable and lasting Syrian-led, Syrian-owned, and UN-facilitated political process.
RT's Murad Gazdiev has more.
In their closing statement, the three foreign ministers of Russia, Iran, and Turkey wrote that they presented the positive results of their consultations on the formation of a Syrian constitutional committee to either rewrite the Syrian constitution or to amend it in order to allow for a wider pan-Syrian election, presidential election, part of a political resolution to this war that has raged on for so many years. The ministers themselves, from what we saw, were smiling and laughing afterwards. They described their work as, again, positive, and they have committed to seeing the Syrian Constitutional Committee sit for its first session early next year, early 2019. We hope, of course, that they'll be able to do this, because this trio that have been working together for several years now, Russia, Iran, and Turkey, they've been able to produce results, yield concrete results. We've seen ceasefires in Syria established with their backing. We've seen withdrawals, other deals, de-escalations, demilitarized zones established all over Syria. So there's a lot of optimism going forward that they'll be able to get the rebels, the opposition, and the Syrian government to work together. Earlier on, the Turkish foreign minister, though, did remark that they had seen very little cooperation from the United States and the coalition that it leads. The United States itself has shared its goals, has publicly stated that its aims with regards to Syria have shifted, and it no longer sees unseating President Bashar al-Assad or regime change in Syria as a goal.
We're not asking for regime change. We're not asking for the Russians to leave. What we're asking for is a compromise settlement. There's a strong readiness on the part of Western nations not to ante up money for that disaster unless we have some kind of idea that the government is ready to compromise and thus not create yet another horror in the years ahead.
Nevertheless, the situation in Syria remains volatile, especially now with Turkey threatening to intervene, to invade northern Syria out of security concerns, as they see the YPG, Syrian Kurds that control much of northern Syria, as a terrorist organization, and they have threatened to act. We're also seeing sporadic fighting in Idlib with jihadists joined by rebels there, and the Syrian Arab army clashing from time to time. So there's certainly motivation to get things done.
The U.N. Special Representative for Syria, Stefan de Mistura, spoke on Tuesday about the situation in that country.
I believe that there is an extra mile to go. In the marathon effort to ensure the necessary package for a credible, balanced, and inclusive constitutional committee, and for including a balanced chairing arrangement and drafting body and voting threshold to be established under the UN auspices in Geneva. These consultations were a key part of our own intensive effort at the request of the Secretary General to fundamentally advance the possibility of establishing a Syrian-owned, Syrian-led, UN-facilitated constitutional committee in order to draft for a popular approval a constitutional reform as contribution to the political settlement in Syria that gives effect to the Sochi final statement of 30 January 2018, within the context of the Geneva process to implement Security Council Resolution 2254. I'm not tired. I'm not frustrated. In our job, we cannot afford to be frustrated. Otherwise, you will never be a mediator. You can't be a doctor and be frustrated by diseases. But I did so because at a certain point, there is a need to draw a line on your personal life as well, at least for a period. And B, because I found a excellent successor, who I know will be not only doing along the lines of what we've done, but do even better.
Meanwhile, the UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process, Nikolai Mladenov, gave the UN Security Council Monday a year-end report on the status of peace negotiations between Israel and Palestine.
The continued expansion of the Israeli settlement enterprise in all of its aspects is illegal in international law, undermines hope among the population, trust between the parties, and the two-state solution itself. And each time, as the parties came frighteningly close to the brink of war, tireless efforts by Egypt and the United Nations prevented a full-fledged conflict, ultimately reuniting Gaza and the West Bank under a single, legitimate, and democratic Palestinian authority, and putting an end to the occupation will ensure long-term peace. Meanwhile, however, it is imperative that the calm be preserved at all costs. No one can afford another war in Gaza. Ongoing instances of incitement, provocative steps, and inflammatory rhetoric plague the public language of the conflict. They are highly dangerous and threaten to push an already volatile situation past the boiling point. I believe that I speak on behalf of all of us today when I say that we all share a concern that at the end of 2018, we're nowhere closer to reviving efforts for a negotiated solution. Without a political horizon, all our collective and individual efforts merely contribute to managing the conflict rather than resolving it.
Following that report, the following comments were delivered to the media Monday by Ambassador Riyad Mansour, Palestine's permanent representative to the United Nations, on the situation in his country.
In the debate that took place, we agree with some of the points that were raised by Mr. Mladenov. Of course, we disagree with him on other issues. And we support the 10 countries who have reiterated their request that the report should have been in writing by the Secretary General and circulated to member states ahead of time to be able to have a very constructive and positive debate in the Security Council on the basis of a written report. Let me also say that The ambassador of the United States gave her last speech, and her last speech is similar to her first speech when she came to the Security Council 2 years ago. She has been trying for 2 years to convince members of the Security Council and the international community to abandon international law, to abandon the global consensus of how to solve this problem in which the international community spent at least 25 years building, which is the parameter, the two-state solution, ending occupation, just solution to the refugee questions, and all the elements of the global consensus. She reiterated this position in her last speech before departure this time, and the 14 other members of the Security Council upheld the international law, Security Council resolution, including 2334, and she failed again in not convincing a single one of them of replacing the global consensus of how to solve the problem by the ideas and the thinking of President Trump, in which she said she read the plan, but she did not share anything that was clear. And in essence, she wanted the thinking of President Trump to replace the global consensus, and not a single country in the Security Council approved or agreed with her on that articulation. So as she is leaving, as she came in, she did not succeed in changing the thinking of the Security Council, definitely not the 14 members of the Security Council. And in all of her tenure, the 2 years, she did not criticize a single action or policy by Israel in the occupied territory. And this way, she shifted the position of the United States to be identical with the position of Israel, and therefore contributed to the isolation of the United States from the other members of the Security Council and marginalizing their effectiveness in playing a very positive role in solving this conflict. As we end the year, I just want to say last year was a very difficult year for us because the United States administration took very belligerent unilateral positions, starting from Jerusalem, going through UNRWA and refugees, against the Palestinian people and their cause. And I am satisfied to say the U.S. administration did not succeed in the destruction of UNRWA. In the contrary, the international community is defending UNRWA very strongly and was able to come up with a deficit of $440 million when the United States decided not to pay $300 million of it, as they have promised at the beginning of the year. The deficit today is $21 million. They did not succeed in fundamentally changing the thinking of the United Nations on the global consensus. The international community, as one see it in the many resolutions adopted and in the position of the Security Council, they are still upholding these positions, and the position of the United States along with Israel is extremely isolated. And I am happy to say that the Palestinian people were able to withstand this onslaught and succeed on the adoption of all of their resolutions with fundamentally the same essence and fundamentally very similar voting pattern to the year before and the year before. If you have any question, I'm available to you. Yes, sir.
It carries on very neat to what we were talking about in terms of UNRWA managing to stop the deficit in funding, but you've got other funding issues, or rather the UN Aid Office announced yesterday a reduction in its 2019 spending plan. So it's gone down by 200 million, and there's 500,000 fewer Palestinians are going to be receiving aid, particularly in Gaza. What does that say about your support
with international donors, but also what does that look like on the ground in places like Gaza City, Ramallah, and so on for 2019 in terms of the humanitarian situation? Is it looking bleak for you guys?
No, it is not. Even in the one listen to the debate, that there was a clear message that as we were collectively able, you know, to withstand this onslaught by the current U.S. administration by denying $300 million to UNRWA, $25 million to hospitals in East Jerusalem, and also further reduction to the Palestinian Authority, the Palestinian people were able to receive a massive political support from the international community and financial support. One example is bridging, you know, the deficit of UNRWA from $440 million to $21 million. The same message is going to be transferred to the year 2019, next year, and we sincerely hope that this political support and financial support would continue. And let me also add that we are grateful to the international community by putting their trust on us to lead the G77 in the year 2019. It's a grouping of 134 countries, that's including China, and populated by these countries of 80% of humanity. To put such a trust on us to lead the humanity in negotiations of 70% of the agenda of the UN, which is the developmental agenda, is a great honor for the Palestinian people. And I am delighted to announce that President Mahmoud Abbas will be here on 15th of January to receive the baton from our Egyptian brothers as a leader of the G77 and China for the year 2019.
Ambassador, sorry, I was in the daily press briefing. Do you mind if I ask a question about Ambassador Haley? I hope you don't mind me recalling the fact that you've been here quite a long time. You've seen many US ambassadors come and go. If you look at those ambassadors that you've dealt with over the years and then compare Ambassador Haley with the others that you've dealt with, where does she go on the league table in your mind of ambassadors that you've dealt with from the United States?
I think in part I addressed this issue before you came, but let me just say that unfortunately with the this current representative, well, actually she is leaving us, as also reflecting the policies of the current U.S. administration, her style was more aggressive and more pro-Israelis than perhaps the style of others. She was acting as being more Israelis than the Israeli representative himself, which is very unfortunate. We know that different representatives of the United States of America were always showing massive support to Israel, but yet in the same time they were a bit more balanced in terms of not ignoring the Palestinian side completely. Ambassador Haley, unfortunately, exhibited, you know, excessive amount of hostility to the Palestinian people and to the Palestinian cause, and she crusaded to replace the global consensus with her ideas, and I suppose also the ideas of President Trump. And I can say after 2 years she failed in convincing any significant number of countries at the United Nations with these ideas. The last one was her speech today in the Security Council, in which she repeated the same themes that she started with 2 years ago, and she did not convince any of the 14 members of the Security Council to replace the global consensus with other ideas, because the 14 others and the great majority of the international community said that we invested a lot during the tens of years in the past, including with U.S. representatives and previous administration, in reaching this global consensus. And as it was articulated by our European colleagues who spoke here before me, you know, earlier this morning that they said that they don't see anything to replace ending the occupation, two-state solution, and the parameter to be able to be taken seriously and to succeed. Any other ideas that might be contemplated by the current U.S. administration to replace this global consensus as one to listen closely to what was debated inside the General Assembly Hall, it indicates that it will not have a chance of succeeding. It's dead on arrival. She refused to listen to these positions that she heard for the last 2 years, and she left without listening to them, insisting that the replacement of the global consensus with something that is so vague, which we don't know, is will succeed. She is wrong. It will not succeed. The only thing that has a chance of success is to implement the global consensus. Thank you.
On Tuesday, Israel's permanent representative to the UN, Danny Danon, spoke with the media on the situation between Israel and Lebanon.
Hello, good morning. Today we are addressing Hezbollah's terror tunnel network, which the terrorist organization has been able to build despite the presence of the Lebanese armed forces and UNIFIL. There have been 38 reports on Resolution 1701. At the Security Council last year, I exposed Hezbollah's violations. Yet, unbelievably, Major General Bibi, the former UNIFIL commander, had stated, and I quote, during a visit on the border with the IDF officials and Ambassador Haley, General Bibi said, "The region is calm. The situation is good. There is no need to change. The facts, however, are clear. The situation is not good. We need to see a change." On UNIFIL's watch, Hezbollah has been digging tunnels from Lebanese villages such as Kfar Kela and using its own people as human shields. Israel even revealed to UNIFIL that a high-ranking member of the Lebanese armed forces actively cooperates with Hezbollah. When UNIFIL told the Lebanese army about the tunnels, the Lebanese army sends information straight to Hezbollah immediately, which then sealed the tunnels to destroy the evidence. These tunnels cross the blue line in violation of Israel's sovereignty. They are designed for one purpose: to attack Israel and terrorize its citizens. This is part of Hezbollah's plan to invade the Galilee, our northern part, and destroy Israel. We know this because in 2013, Hassan Nasrallah, Hezbollah's Secretary General, publicly discussed this operation, and he called it Conquest of the Galilee. 2 weeks ago, the IDF launched Operation Northern Shield to neutralize and destroy these tunnels. So far, the IDF has uncovered 4 that cross the blue line. You can see from their locations here in the map, you can see the tunnels coming from Lebanon into Israel next to our communities. Some of the tunnels are only meters from UNIFIL observation points. You can see that it perfectly aligns with Nasrallah's operations. This is no coincidence. What you are seeing is Hezbollah's conquest of the Galilee battle plan in action. This is just the ground component of an offensive that will use Hezbollah's arsenal, over 100,000 rockets and missiles, to strike all of Israel. Make no mistake, if Hezbollah forces our hand, we will act swiftly, and we will do it with full force. Thank you.
Ambassador, it's Pamela Falk from CBS News. Your prime minister has called for UN action. Can you see anything happening at the Security Council on these tunnels or on Hezbollah generally? Thank you.
Well, first, I think the Security Council should designate Hezbollah as a terrorist organization, the same way the Security Council designated Al-Qaeda, ISIL, and other terrorist organizations. That's what we expect from the Security Council, a clear condemnation But also, we expect them to say something to Lebanon, to the sovereign government of Lebanon. But because if, God forbid, there will be an escalation and there will be casualties on those villages in southern Lebanon, and I will reveal more information in the council, the Security Council will convene and blame Israel. Today, they should demand more from the Lebanese government.
Thank you. Mr. Ambassador, what have the Lebanese said, if they've said anything in advance of this meeting, either Hezbollah or the supposedly sovereign government of Lebanon? Are they asserting a right to invade or penetrate a neighboring state through or under a recognized international border, or what have any of them said?
Well, I believe that Hezbollah took over part of the government of Lebanon. We are waiting to hear the Lebanese ambassador speaking to the council in a few minutes. She wrote a letter to the council complaining about Israel, but we haven't heard them speaking publicly about Hezbollah. And it is about time that they will confront Hezbollah. For the sake of the people of Lebanon, they should confront Hezbollah.
Ambassador, can we ask you about another issue of pressing concern right now? There are reports that President Trump is planning to pull all the U.S. troops out of Syria. In your assessment, is the threat from ISIL in Syria finished? And are you concerned about Israel's security if those troops leave Syria?
Well, it is a U.S. decision, and we will respect any decision made by the administration. We have our concerns about Syria, about the presence of Iranian troops in Syria, and we will do whatever is necessary to protect our people, regardless if you have American troops, Russian troops, or any other nations. So we will continue to follow our policy of not allowing the Iranians to build their bases next to our borders.
You mentioned Iran. What about ISIL? Is ISIL defeated in Syria, in Israel's estimation?
Well, for sure we can tell that ISIS has been defeated in Syria. You can argue whether it's completed or not, but overall we can agree with the international community that the fight against ISIS...
Russia announced that it is prepared for a U.S. withdrawal from the INF Treaty. Press TV's Marina Kortanova has more.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has warned that Russia can easily make and deploy land-based intermediate-range missiles if the U.S. withdraws from the Nuclear Arms Control Treaty. The Russian leader said if the United States leaves the INF Treaty, Russia will be able to modernize air and sea-based systems by placing them on land complexes. Experts say Moscow has all power and infrastructure for a tit-for-tat move against Washington.
Russia has sea-based launchers that can easily be deployed on land and in which missiles can be placed. It has all the necessary components for the development of the infrastructure for the use of medium-range missiles of caliber NK and the ability to produce such missiles in the required quantity in order to create an adequate threat to the United States and Europe, the Middle East, and other regions.
Putin accused the U.S. of violating the Intermediate-Range Nuclear Forces Treaty by placing its missile systems in Romania and Poland. Russia's response has been its recent advances in creation of new types of weapons that have no analogies in the world.
Let's see how this will happen. By and large, we already have everything. But if something happens that is trying to frighten us, well, we will have to respond accordingly.
Russia says it's not in breach of INF Treaty and that it's the United States who is violating it. Experts also say it's the Trump administration that will be blamed for tearing the treaty up. The U.S. president has already a disappointing track record of abandoning landmark deals clinched by his predecessors from the 2015 Iran nuclear agreement to treaties on trade and climate change.
In 1987, the USSR and the USA signed the Treaty on the Elimination of Intermediate-Ranged and Shorter-Ranged Missiles. Then the world stood on the edge, and it seemed that this would not happen again. The Soviet Union was unilaterally disarmed, while the United States continued to build up its naval, air, and land-based weapon systems. The leadership of the Soviet Union agreed to this unilateral disarmament, but modern Russia does not intend to make such mistakes in the future. Marina Kortanova, Press TV, Moscow.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.